Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
This is episode 164 of the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prosser, and my co-host, Andrew Frankel. Now, this week, we're talking about our favourite ever road car engines. There's some spectacular stuff in here. And actually, we're talking about our favourite engines rather than, I don't know, the greatest engines, because we wanted this to be sort of our personal lists, and we wanted to share our own experiences with some of these engines. So I hope you enjoy listening. Before we get started, though, please just remember, whichever podcast app you're using, just hit the follow button or hit the subscribe button. It means you never miss an episode, and it really, really helps us, actually helps us to find a bigger podcast audience. So please do that and enjoy the episode. Andrew, to get things started, I wonder if 1LR-GUE means anything to you. It sounds like a car registration plate or something, doesn't it? But it's not.
Is it the engine code for a Japanese V10?
Well, it is. Well done. Oh, I'm impressed though. I thought you'd have no idea.
Built by Yamaha.
Indeed it is. It is. Yeah, very well done. It's a 4.8 litre V10. I'll go through the specs in a moment. But it is the engine from the Lexus LFA, which I drove for the very first time yesterday. Now, as we're talking our favourite road car engines of all time, I mean, that has to be in there. And is it on your list as well?
Absolutely. 100%. Yeah. I think Clarkson says it's the best engine that there's ever been. And I don't know how you measure that. It can only ever be a subjective view, can't it? But it's absolutely up there. I mean, it's a... when I think of what I want an engine to be, how I want it to sound, how I want it to respond, you know, that's the engine, isn't it?
It is.
Absolutely mighty.
But why they called it 1LR-GUE?
I have no clue.
Anyway, so it's... Yeah, I drove an LFA for the first time yesterday. I'll be writing about it for the TI app and website very, very soon. And we were on the South Coast on a brilliant coast road that overlooks Chesil Beach. Never been there before, but it's a fantastic spot. We had great weather. Hopefully the images will come out beautifully. I suspect they will do. But that car is an experience. And it's, of course, it's an experience dominated by the engine. Let me just run through some of the specifications because it is a special thing. So it's aluminium alloy, magnesium alloy, and titanium alloy. Those are the sort of three main materials. It's a compact engine. Toyota say, or Lexus say, it's more compact than most than a typical V8. Yeah. And it was co-developed with Yamaha. Interestingly, the exhaust system had input from Yamaha's music division, which sort of makes sense, doesn't it, when you hear the thing?
Oh, the people who make the pianos.
Exactly. So they understand.
When you hear it,
sonics.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, it's an extraordinary sound. It revs like a mad thing. The sort of apocryphal tale, maybe it is true, was that it revs from nothing to the red line in 0.6 of a second, And so a mechanical tachometer couldn't keep up, so they had to use a digital one. Whether or not that's true, I don't know, but it's a nice little tale, isn't it?
If you blend it, I mean, you can believe it should. It feels like it hasn't got a flywheel at all, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's just,
yeah,
the response, so free spinning. Yeah.
Just lights up. Forged aluminium pistons, forged titanium con rods, dry sump, so it sits low in the chassis, 10 individual throttle bodies, so that helps with that lightning response. They say it's as light, or I think lighter actually, than Toyota's own 3.5-litre V6. So that is a special engine, and when you look at the spec sheet, they went to town with that thing. They did everything they could to produce an engine of lightning responses with a wonderful soundtrack. And it's just worth the effort, isn't it?
It's quite an old engine now, isn't it? What year was the car you drove?
So it was 2011, I believe.
Yeah, so it's like a 12-year-old engine now.
Yeah.
Which means that, you know, there's been a long time, hasn't there, for stuff to come along. And you know, we will clearly talk about engines which, for their, you know, for their sense of occasion and everything else, you know, probably rival it. But it's got, what, 550 horsepower from a 4.8?
Yeah, 553. So it's 115 bhp per litre, which is massively high for an NA engine, isn't it? Massively high.
Yeah. Although, and maybe we'll talk about this engine in a minute, I don't think it's any higher than you get in a Honda S2000.
Interesting.
So that's 230-something out of a 2-litre engine. It's about the same, isn't it?
That is, yeah, so that is identical, isn't it? That is identical. Yeah. Gosh. Yeah. So, do you know what? I think there's going to be a bit of a running theme with the engines I nominate here, because
all going to be redlined beyond 8,000?
Exactly. Isn't that one of the key traits of a truly exciting engine that it revs?
Well, I don't think it has to be. I've got engines on my list which would blow themselves to smithereens long before they got anywhere near those sorts of things. These are engines which are great, either because maybe they're technically clever in some way, or because they're so unbelievably characterful, or because I've got one engine on my list, which is, I wonder if you can tell me what it is. This engine powered everything from Le Mans winners to a hearse, or lots of hearses.
Ooh. No, you're going to have to tell me.
Literally everything. They transported royalty. They made amazing sports cars out of it, amazing limousines out of it. XK. Amazing racing cars out of it.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Now, they go pop at about 6 and a bit. But, oh my goodness. And what a life from the late 40s to the mid-80s. I mean, absolutely extraordinary engine.
Can you tell us the story of that engine then, please?
Well, it first came into being, it first went into production straight after the war, so 48, 49, in the XK120. This was the first engine to go into something which called itself a Jaguar. I mean, SS cars, which were producing cars before the wars, they had Jaguar as a model name, but obviously SS after the war had some somewhat unfortunate connotations. So they changed
and
the name.
And Jaguar is a better name anyway, isn't it? Jaguar is much better.
Jaguar is just a better name. And they came up with this. I mean, it started life as a 3.4. In its time, it went as small as, I think they did a 2.4 in an XJ6. These days, I think Henry Pierman of Eagle E types can get them out to about 4.7. wow. You know, back then it would have had about 140 horsepower when it was new. These days, a proper wide angle fuel injected alloy block race engine will probably produce 400 horsepower.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just unbelievable. And it was designed, it was so good. Get this, it was designed as a road car engine. Yeah. Mm. And you know, that's why it's got quite a long stroke, quite a narrow bore. It wasn't designed to go racing, and they were going to do this whole other engine, this V12 engine, which eventually did kind of appear, you know, years and years later in the XJ13, which was going to be their race engine. But this, you know, they stuck this engine in the competition version of the XK120, which they called the C-Type, and it just started winning Le Mans and doing this, and they just thought, well, there's just no need, we'll just use this instead. So it was an engine which won Le Mans five times in the 1950s, which was never designed to be a racing engine.
That is amazing, isn't it? It was just that good. It was just that good.
It was just that good. So that's, yeah, that's definitely high up my list.
So you've mentioned the Honda S2000. That's not on my list, but I have got a little four-cylinder Honda VTEC, because it has to be there, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, to me, I mean, I'm kind of calling them, I'm putting them all under the same umbrella, whether it's a, excuse me, a 1.6 or a 2-litre or anything in between.
So I'm looking at the B18C5.
Oh, yes, the old B18C5.
These engine codes are so boring, aren't they? They're so dull.
I've no idea which Civic that ended up in.
No. Well, that was the Integra Type R, actually, the DC2.
Okay. Yeah.
So this is the 1.8 litre. And actually, it's on my list because it demonstrates that thrilling, exotic engines needn't be V10s or V12s.
No.
They just don't have to be. They can be little four cylinders in affordable cars.
Yes, but they need two things. One is they need to have incredible engineers behind them. And secondly, as is absolutely the case with VTEC, they just need to be really bloody clever.
Mm.
And VTEC is, you know, Andrew English did a story, which is out on the website and the app at the moment, explaining about VTEC, because he's just bought one of the last, I think, Civic Type R's to use a version of that engine.
Yeah.
And it is so, the way it works is so simple and so clever. So basically what you have is you have an engine that's sort of running away, and it gets up to about 5,500 revs, at which stage hydraulic pressure forces a pin through the camshaft, which engages a whole other set of different cams, which are much sharper, and so they're much higher lift, and I think longer duration too. And so basically, it's like you've just bolted a completely different cylinder head to the car. And suddenly, and you will remember, you know, it goes along, and it's not, there's nothing sort of progressive about it. Suddenly, the engine note sharpens, goes very hard, and then the revs just go flying off around the clock. And it was
a switch. You
know, it's just like a switch. And, you know, also because they were Honda and they love this stuff and they understand it and they're clever, they always fitted. Because, I mean, these VTEC systems tended not to come until about 5,500, and then they were with you until just after the, usually the red line was somewhere just the other side of eight. But they always fitted these cars with transmissions, amazingly quick and swift transmissions, but with ratios that would allow you to keep the VTEC active all the time. So you'd never fall back below that level where that pin moved and the proper cam profiles came in. And so you could always keep them on the bottle. I completely agree with you. It was just such a, you know, one of those howling around a truck. I remember taking an Integra Type R around Goodwood and just having the most fun in it. And okay, it's a beautiful handling car too, but that engine was unbelievable. And I think Andrew English told me, I think they said they've never had a claim on one.
Yeah,
they're basically indestructible.
Yeah, it is extraordinary. They are phenomenal things. And do you know what, on the gear ratio point, the one car that I've come across with a Honda VTEC engine that didn't feel quite right was an Accord Type R. And you had to hit the limiter, shift really quickly, upshift really quickly to stay within the VTEC zone. If you shifted slightly early or you were a bit tardy with your shift, you'd drop off the cam and then you'd have to labour back up to it and it would light up again. But you're right, in most Hondas, the ratios are just perfect that you can stay on that hotter cam. And then it's just fantastically exciting. A really sort of hard-edged barking sound. Really dramatic, exciting power delivery at the top end. It was fantastic. And this was, what I love about those engines is that it wouldn't happen these days because it would be far easier and far cheaper just to put a turbo on it.
Yeah.
And you'd get decent response.
Yeah.
You'd get a load of torque, good power. But you'd have nothing like the character. But back then, it was worth the effort. It was worth engineering these engines.
But also, if you did it, if you did it now, I mean, you might sell a small number of hot hatches, but people wouldn't. People would just wouldn't. You know, people wouldn't want a a little engine with no torque. I mean, these things, you know, they develop peak torque at about 7,000 revs.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, the world's moved on, and you know, and all they are far less characterful. You know, a modern turbo engine with, you know, a wall of torque from, you know, 1800 RPM is just a more usable thing. It's a shame, really.
In that piece that you spoke about by Andrew English, he talks about for a long, long time, Honda engines were all about revs. That's how they made their power, wasn't it? They just they revved high. And let's not forget that Honda, when it was participating in Formula One, particularly in the 80s and 90s, as an engine supplier, it won many Formula One world championships, 11 actually, during the 80s and 90s, six in the constructors, five in the teams, in the drivers, excuse me. V12s, V10s, also turbo V6s. So they really learned during that period how to make an engine rev high reliably.
Yeah.
And there really is filter, you know, that know-how, that engineering expertise really did filter down from those Formula One engines into the road car engines. And that connection is just super cool. I love that. It makes them so special.
It does. And I think it feels special because there is no secret to it. To make an engine like that little four-cylinder VTEC engine rev that high, produce that much power, and that itself is not very difficult to do if you don't mind having an engine which is going to go bang after 25,000 miles. Yeah. But to do it in an engine which will just go and go and go and go and go for, you know, likely the lifetime of the car, you only do that just through exquisite engineering, just total attention to quality. And that's what I really love about it. It's, you know, you drive one of those cars and, okay, it's a little Japanese hatchback, but you just know that it has some of the finest engineering in it and some of the finest engineering brains behind it that have ever designed anything that's gone on a car.
Yeah. And the right materials. They really, they gave it everything, didn't they?
Because they cared.
Which is, they really, really cared. And actually, just final point on the Integra Type I engine, the DC2 model. Yeah, it made 131 pounds foot at 7,300 RPM. so it is this, you would just get dropped by a modern turbo diesel Golf, wouldn't you?
Golf.
If you weren't in the right gear.
Yeah.
But, gosh, they are exciting. They really are exciting.
Can we deal with the obvious one?
McLaren F1.
Well, no, I wasn't going to say that. No, even more obvious than that.
Oh, go on.
You tend to find them in the back of cars, and they've got six cylinders.
Are we talking Mesger engine?
We are talking Mesger engines. Yeah. What is it about that engine? What it's like, to anybody going, huh, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you could apply it to all air-cooled Porsche 911 engines, because he had a hand in all of them, but particularly the sort of the race engine that ended up in the road cars, which... I mean, I just find it amazing that it's not quite true that no one else has ever done the flat six. Subaru did one. I think Tucker did one in the 1950s. Yeah. But the flat six engine, maybe it's just the way that Porsche do them. I don't know. But it is such a fabulous power unit. The way it delivers its power, the noise that it makes, the fact that it keeps you... center of gravity of the car right down on the deck. I mean, it's just, to me, it's still quite compact. It seems to me to be such an optimal configuration. And I think what happened is that Porsche made such a name for themselves by doing it. Everybody else just thought, well, that's theirs. We can't go there.
And do you know what? Yeah. You sometimes feel shortchanged with a V6 because it's not a V8 or a 10 or a 12. But you never think with a flat six, God, I wish I had a couple more cylinders here.
Never. Never,
bizarre, isn't it?
I mean, they are so smooth. And that, what does that Metzger engine rev to? 9,000, best part of. And you get there, and instead of thinking, oh my God, this thing's going to blow up. You think, well, why isn't it doing 10 or 11? Because it just wants to go and go and go. And again, another engine which is, I can remember talking to the guys at Porsche, because, I mean, they kept that engine on. You know, it was quite an old engine by this time they stopped using it. I said, why do you keep on using this engine? Why? And they said, because we know it. You know, this is an engine that can survive 24 hours at Le Mans standing on its head. And so, you know, we know what it can do. We know it won't let us down at all. It'll be absolutely bomb-proof. And, you know, tell me what's wrong with it. And, of course, the answer is absolutely nothing.
But it couldn't live forever, and it was replaced for the 991, wasn't it, with the... the new first 3.8 litre and then later 4 litre, a new flat six.
Yeah.
And I wonder which one you prefer, because honestly, you drive a GT3 or a GT3 RS now with the newer engine. They're all 4 litres now, aren't they? And it's a phenomenal engine, that one. It's a phenomenal engine. And I wonder if people really do miss the old Metzger one from the 997 and 996.
I think it's a very good question. I think there probably is an element of, you know, rose-tinted spectacles about these things. You know, the modern engine, you know, it delivers a heap more power, revs just as high. It sounds bonkers. I mean, when I went over to America to drive that, an old Bentley, I happened to spend some time in a GT4 RS Cayman. Mm. I mean, the cabin noise in that car is, I mean, you know, on the right road, it is utterly inspirational. I mean, I wouldn't want to do a massive distance in it, if I'm honest. But yeah, so, I mean, is it a better engine than the Metzger engine? I think I guess it's because the Metzger engine has this more historic component, because it was in the back of the GT1 98, which won Le Mans outright in 1998. So it has that sort of pedigree. And even though the current engine has won its class at Le Mans multiple times in the back of in the middle of an RSR, it hasn't quite got that history to it. But objectively, if any way you look at it, yes, absolutely as good, probably better than the Metzger engine. But that's progress.
Yeah, they're phenomenal engines, both of them. while we're on the subject of Porsche, do we just have to tick off the Carrera GT V10? I've only driven one of those cars very briefly, but you just sort of have to hear it howling to fall for that engine, don't you?
You do, but I mean, I just thought the problem with doing a podcast like this with great engines is, you know, you could do a pod series on great engines. You know, you and I could do an entire podcast on that engine alone. And I've been sitting there trying to, and I think to myself, when I think about sort of V10s, I think to myself, well, obviously there's the LFA V10, which I would quite like to talk about. There's the BMW V10, which I know had its issues, but oh my goodness. There's the Viper V10, and you know, and so it goes on, and the Audi V10,
Lamborghini,
and so you kind of think, I start thinking of it, I'm going to start rationing these engines a bit, so maybe I could only have a couple of V10s in it. And if I could only have a couple of V10s, I'd have the Lexus in my list. I'd have the Lexus and the BMW engine, because the BMW engine, it was such a bonkers engine to put in a 5 Series.
Yeah, it was. It was. And actually, when you look at the specs, that's such a highly specified engine with individual throttle bodies, the materials they used. Again, they went to town with that thing. And as we know, in later ones, later M5s, well, you just put a V8 in it with a couple of turbos and away you go.
Exactly. And, you know, you get way more power, you get way more torque, but objectively, you get a far better engine. It has more performance, more power. I'm sure it'll use less fuel, just better in every way. But it just isn't the same, is it?
It's not the same.
A V10, a really fast-spinning V10 with not much torque low down, it's an absolutely rubbish engine to have in a big saloon or a big estate. You know, it's the same criticism that I have aimed at the Ferrari Purosangue, because love Ferrari's V12, though I absolutely do. It's just not the right engine to have in a car like that. But there is something so gloriously incongruous and nutty about having an engine which really genuinely does sound like it should be in a racing car in a 5 Series estate.
Completely agree. Can I give you one of mine that proves that I'm not all about 9,000 RPM redlines?
Go on.
Although this one revs quite well. It's the 6.2-litre AMG V8, but specifically the one in the SLS Black Series.
Yeah.
That thing is phenomenal, because it's a big displacement engine, 6.2 litres. So it's not like some of the other V10s we're talking about, where you have to wring it out. It's got massive torque, and it just, in the mid-range, it almost feels turbocharged. It's that strong. You get that big rush, that hit of torque, and the thing just takes off.
And the noise.
That rumbling soundtrack. Yeah. It's a gorgeous sound. But it actually does rev that thing as well. So it's not like a bit of Detroit Iron that's done at 6. You know, I think it goes probably beyond 7, that thing. And particularly in that car, the SLS Black Series, a low, very sporting car. It is unbelievable. It It dominates the driving experience in that thing. And it makes it one of the most exciting road cars I've ever come across. I adore that motor.
And I think there's a reason why it's as good as it is. Because it was an engine that AMG did for itself. It wasn't a tuned-up version of something which you got in other Mercedes. It was the first engine where they just said, okay, this is our engine.
Yeah.
And it was done entirely by AMG for AMG. And I think it's a calling card. I think they were just saying, okay, guys, this is what we can do. And I think that's why it was that good. I have to say, the engine that preceded it, you will have been around to drive the supercharged 5.5-litre V8 that was in basically everything from, you know, from an E-Class to an SLR. That was a characterful engine.
Yeah.
I mean, the SLR was a very, very flawed car, but my goodness, the engine in it. Yeah. Actually, the biggest problem with that engine, and indeed most of the cars that it went into, was that it had so much torque. You know, they had to tie it to that, you know, shonky old slushy five-speed auto gearbox, which kind of ruined it. But the engine itself was a marvel.
So there we go.
It's the only supercharged engine I got on my list.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. And I wonder if you've got any turbo engines on your list.
I bet I do. I haven't even thought about it like that. Have I got any turbo? Yes, I do. There you go.
Oh, well done. Is it in the middle of an F40?
Do you know what? If I thought of it, it would have been. but it's not. how did I manage to miss that? No, this one is in the front of a Rolls-Royce, more recently and more often a Bentley. It's the 6¾-litre. Some friends came to stay recently. He's done quite well for himself, so he turned up in his Mulsanne. As you know, the last couple of hundred yards getting to my house is not the easiest bit of terrain to negotiate if you're in anything, let alone a Mulsanne. So when people come here, be they, you know, sort of delivery drivers or mates or whatever in big cars, I always just go and meet them, and then I just drive it in myself because I know where all the lumps and bumps are. So anyway, the long and the short of this, I drove this Mulsanne. I probably drove it about 300 yards. But even then, I probably didn't do more than 20 miles an hour in it. Even then, just to hear that woofle, that sort of that far-off thunder, and just to be reminded of what that engine did for that car and how utterly... I mean, to me, that is what a true luxury, hedonistic engine should be like. I used to say to Uli Eichhorn, who was Bentley's chief engineer for a long time and did a huge amount of work on that engine, that really, if you're going to be really purist about it, you wouldn't have a gearbox. You just have direct drive to the rear axle because it would have so much torque.
Yeah.
And it's one of those engines, I think it's got like a sort of 1,000 newton. I mean, it has as much torque as, you know, basically the limiting factor is trying to find a gearbox strong enough to take it. And I used to, when I had them, I used to go on big cross-country journeys in them and see if I could do the entire journey without ever using more than 2,000 revs.
Yes, and that's the engine for it, isn't it?
And you just could. And you could just go at great speed from place to place and never do more than 2,000 revs. I just love locking it in a high gear and just leaving the torque to do the work. It just felt so effortless and because of that, so wonderfully luxurious. And although, you know, the W12 that they've used until very recently, you know, hit all the right numbers, it was never close to being as characterful an engine as that. No. Nothing like a satisfactory.
I'm glad it's on your list because it demonstrates that a great engine or engines that we love are not just those Banshees that howl to 9,000 or that
produce a noise like thunder. That engine is all washed up at 4.4.
Yeah, and it's not a performance engine.
No.
But what it does do is it perfectly suits the car that it's in.
Exactly.
And that's half the battle, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's why, you know, a Ferrari V12 in an 812 Superfast is a simply unbelievable engine.
Yeah.
In a pure sangue, it's flawed, compromised.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I want to give you a couple more and then we'll come back to you. So these are fantastic engines that are exceedingly affordable. And one of them is the S54, naturally aspirated 3.2-litre inline six.
In the
E46 BMW M3.
That's not one. I put a line through that one on my list.
That's from the time where BMW M was really as much about engines as anything else. The engines were the heart and soul of those, of M cars from that era.
Absolutely. Hence the V10.
Yes, and that inline six, it's so raspy, so zingy, it revs beautifully, really good power, but it's not, you know, some sort of horribly highly strung thing that you have to overwork. You know, it's still got 3.2 litres, so it still pulls quite well through the mid-range. Really peaky, zingy soundtrack, particularly in the CSL, where you've got a bit more power and a little bit less weight.
And the carbon fibre intake.
Yes, exactly. But actually, my favourite installation of that engine ever was in the stunt cars, the Aston Martin DB5 stunt cars that they made for No Time to Die.
Because you drove one, didn't you?
I did drive one, yeah. Because that thing weighs about 1,000 kilograms. They built a few of them. But they weigh 1,000 kilograms. And you've got this wonderful, raspy, zingy engine with very little weight to work against. And it's so exciting. It goes like stink while sounding fantastic. Now, you can't exactly go out and buy one of those DB5 stunt cars, but you can have an M3 for probably 15 grand or something, I would have thought now.
Yeah, long may it last. And this engine isn't on my list, and I wouldn't actually have mentioned it if you hadn't started talking about that. But now that you have, I do want to mention, so I've got an M340i out here. And I just want to shout out the engine that's in that, which is still, you know, a 3-litre straight six BMW engine. It is turbocharged. And I just think it is, you know, that engine, which has powered, you know, so many, everything from a sort of M135i up to, you know, M4s and M3s and that sort of thing. It is, and I know there are many different variants of it, but it is such a capable, characterful engine. And in this car I got here, this M340i, I've been trying to work out what is so good about it and why. And obviously the fact it's a straight six and incredibly smooth is great, and it's got 300 whatever it is, 50 horsepower, which is nice. But I think it's a slightly strange engine in that, you know, it's a six-cylinder engine, which are increasingly rare these days in cars like that. Most people have highly turbocharged fours. It's got a very long stroke and a very narrow bore, which is extremely unfashionable because that's not what you want for power. But what it does do is it provides torque, and it's also got a very high compression ratio, and it gets away with that because it's not blowing much boost. So it's a very lightly turbocharged, quite large capacity, long stroke, narrow bore engine, and for a road car it just works stunningly well, because you drive that car and you might think it's a naturally aspirated 4.5-litre engine, because you are just not aware of it being turbocharged in any way, apart from the fact that it's so efficient, it seems to be doing 40 miles to the gallon everywhere. So I just want to shout out that. And also, particularly in a modern context where everyone's going from, you know, six cylinders down to four and, you know, that sort of thing, just having a straight six engine, not a V6 engine, but a lovely, smooth, straight six engine. It's increasingly rare. And very lovely when you come across one.
Yeah, fantastic. That is a Yeah, well, I've had that engine in a long termer, and we tuned it up to beyond 400 horsepower, I believe.
Yeah.
And it's, even at that level, it's responsive. It doesn't feel boosty or laggy. It charges around to the red line, loads of torque. It is, and it sounds great as well, doesn't it? It really does sound good. So yeah, I totally agree with that call. Okay. I'm interested to know what you think about this one. And this is mostly because I drove, for the first time a couple of months ago, a Series 1 Lotus Elise. And what I adored about the engine in that car, and it's the Rover K Series, four-cylinder.
Yeah.
What I love about it is that, I mean, a K Series is a, that went in a lot of boring cars.
Oh, it's a mini Metro engine. It's designed yeah. for, well, the second generation Metro and, you know, all that sort of stuff, Rover 200s and so on.
But stick a very lumpy camshaft in it, tune it up, a free-flowing exhaust, and you get this quite aggressive, very rude, snarling, very powerful, very energetic little four-cylinder engine.
Yeah.
And particularly in something like the Elise, which is so light and so raw, so stripped back, and the engine is just over your shoulder, it feels like a purpose-built, clean-sheet performance car engine. And I just love that this humble Rover K-Series, you can tune it up and produce something really quite special with it.
The thing about the K-Series was, it was an absolutely extraordinary engine. And, you know, I think that term actually applies to all K-Series, even the ones that end up in mini Metros.
Yeah.
Because, again, it comes down to engineering. The way they engineer that engine, it's got these bolts that go all the way through the block, which makes it incredibly strong, which meant also that they could make it incredibly light. That's why it works so well in things like the Elise. It's a really, really light engine. And we had, and it must have been the most basic version you could get of it, which was a single cam, 8-valve engine in a 1.1S. It was probably a Rover Metro then. It was still a Metro, which I actually stuck through a hedge. But anyway, even in that car, the humblest, it probably had 60 horsepower. It was a quality engine. It was a real quality engine. And the twin cam 16-valve engines that they put in things like the Rover 214. This was when suddenly out of nowhere, and because Rover started to, you know, get platforms from Honda and that sort of thing, they, you know, after the disasters of all the, you know, the Leyland rubbish, which we can, you know, ignore here, they suddenly started making some really good cars. And the K-Series was so much part of that. And it's almost a sort of like an XK engine in that it was so flexible. It could be powered so many different sorts of cars. I remember they did a Metro record breaker, which they did 24 hours around Millbrook in. And it revved to 8,500 revs. It literally sat there at 8,500 revs going around Millbrook for 24 hours. And it was absolutely fine. And then you got these, you know, things like, you know, the engines that went into, God, you know, the what they call the VHPD engines, the very high performance derivatives, with 200 odd horsepower and dry sumps and everything else. And they were absolute bonkers engines.
Yeah, gosh.
You know, with probably three or more times the power of the base engine from which it was derived. And I absolutely love that about them.
Mm. That flexibility is
superb engine.
Yeah. Cool. Go on. Let's have another one.
Okay. Well, seeing as while we're on the subject of those sorts of engines, and this is going to be, I suppose, a somewhat controversial topic because I think many people will say this is an absolutely rubbish engine. But Ford designed an engine for the Anglia in the late 1950s.
Yes.
Okay. Which was a 1 litre push rod four cylinder engine developing, I think when it came out, 35 horsepower.
Mm.
Well, I've got one of those engines in my Caterham, except this one is a 1.7 litre version of it. It develops 135 horsepower. It breathes through twin 40 Webers. And for just character, I just simply adore it. So this is the Ford, I mean, the Kent engine, they call it, but the cross-flow Ford engine. It didn't start life being cross-flow, but it became cross-flow. And it has wonderful torque, the most amazing sound, and I defy anyone to be behind the wheel of something powered by a decent Crossflow and, you know, and not have a ridiculous grin on their face at the same time. It's a cracking engine. It's a single cam down on the block somewhere with push rods going up. I mean, you know, it's all the things an engine shouldn't be. It's made out of iron. It's got push rods. It's, you know, it's an overhead valve, not overhead cam. It's a piece of rubbish.
Mm.
But it works.
I remember we photographed that your car up in the hills in Wales a little while ago.
Yeah.
And I was in one spot, and it was a very misty day. The visibility wasn't that good. I was standing around waiting for you to come, and I just heard this extraordinary noise that I thought was a low-flying helicopter.
Yeah.
I honestly would have bet money on that being a low-flying helicopter. And I was thinking, why is someone flying about in this? You can't see a thing. And then you just appear over a crest in your little Caterham. I was like, oh, it's Andrew in his 7. It was an extraordinary sound.
With his shitty Crossflow
yeah.
Ford lump of iron stuck out the front.
It was brilliant.
Okay, I'm not going to dwell on that. Okay, I need to dwell a little bit on this next one because I think it is the engine design of which more engines have been produced than any other car in history. In fact, I'm pretty certain it is. So the most popular engine there's ever been.
Is it a V8?
It is a V8. It's a small block Chevy.
Yeah.
All small block Chevys.
How many have they built?
We need Colin Goodwin for that. Colin, if you're listening to this, can you ring in?
Let us know.
Tell us. Who knows? I mean, God knows, but bazillions of the bastards. I mean, just millions and millions and millions. And, you know, this is an engine which came into being in the 1950s, and you can still get them. You know, they don't put them in any, you know, there are engines which call themselves small blocks, but they're not derived from that original engine. But you can still go and buy in a crate. You can still go and buy a crate small block. From Chevrolet, and I just love it. Was the great democratizing engine, and you know, in anything from pickup trucks to racing cars, you know, sedans, anything, the whole lot, that, you know, powered by this fabulous engine, which was, I used to race a Camaro, and it had one of these engines, as highly tuned as you get at the time. So I think we had about 440 horsepower out of it. It was a 5.7, as a lot of them are. The engine had done, when I bought the car, the engine had done 35 races. I did 2 full seasons in it, and we never put a spanner on it.
Bloody hell. That's mighty, isn't it?
Absolutely mighty. And to me, it's just the sound of America. And sadly, you don't hear it that often anymore, but you go over there and you just hear, you know, we all know the noise, don't we? That low rumble. And it could be, and the thing is, you hear that noise and you have no idea what's going to come past. Because as I said, it could be, you know, anything from, you know, some knackered old pickup truck to, you know, some modern sports car. It could be a Corvette. It could be anything. And I love that about it. That it's the engine that, I don't know, it just says America. All I love about American motoring and cars and the way they go about building them is summed up for me in that engine.
And the way they've flooded off the production line. That's not a rare, exotic, unusual engine, is it? They were just
It is the opposite.
Out. Yeah.
It's the ultimate blue-collar engine, but it works. It does the job.
Oh, fantastic. So there are a couple that I'm hoping you're going to nominate, you're yet to come onto.
I've probably forgotten them.
Well, I'll be amazed if you have. But one of them we did mention right at the start. Do we just need to tick off the BMW V12 in the McLaren F1? Just because I feel like this episode will not be complete if we don't at least acknowledge it.
Yeah. I mean, what was it? 30 years ago now.
Yeah.
You know, when I was lucky enough to drive the same F1 that I'd tested for Autocar in 1994, I drove it again 25 years later. You know, the car has aged in many ways, but that engine hasn't. That engine still hits you straight between the eyes every time you touch the throttle. It is an absolute, it's a force of nature, that engine. It's almost like you can't believe it was just designed by human beings. I mean, Paul Roscher, BMW's Paul Roscher, the late Paul Roscher, was the man who was behind it. It was, you know, quite unkindly described as two M3 engines stuck together, and it wasn't. It was, yeah, I mean, I can remember driving it, and they said it didn't have a flywheel. Of course, it did have a flywheel, but it was so free-spinning that if you turned it off, the period of time between you literally switching off the ignition and the engine stop was not measurable. It would just go, and just stop. And it was, I can remember when, back in 94, when we were doing that test, once we'd sort of done everything we needed to do, everybody in the office clearly wanted to come and have a ride in it. And so we went down to the test track, the Long Cross test track, which you will know of old, down in Chobham, where there's a perimeter circuit. And they, you know, so they all queued up, and, you know, I think I gave them like one lap each. And what I'd do was I'd just set off with them, and I'd say, right, I'm going to put my foot down now. And I put my foot all the way down, and they go, God, that's quite impressive. And I said, okay, fine. That was sixth. I'm going to do it in fifth now. And then I'd do fourth. And by the time I got to third, they were screaming. It was, and you could do that. You could trickle away almost from rest in sixth gear. It was so well balanced. The torque curve was so wide. It was, yeah. I mean, at the time, it was an engine unlike anything any of us had ever come across before. And I think it's still, you know, up there, frankly, with, you know, things like, you know, the LFA engine is absolutely, you know, I don't think we should nominate the world's greatest engine, because how do you measure it?
Yeah.
But if you were to go through that process, it would absolutely have to be on there.
Got to be there, hasn't it? I've never even sat in a McLaren F1. Well, not one that's moving anyway. I need to experience that motor. The other one that I hoped you would talk us through is the Colombo V12.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I didn't put it on there only because it just sort of, I didn't want to be too obvious about it. And it is such a... So this was an engine which was designed by Giacchino Colombo for Ferrari in 1947, 1948. And it went into not quite all, but the vast majority of his road cars and his sports racing cars from then, you know, right up to, well, certainly the late 60s. And there was nothing particularly clever about it. And it goes back to what we were talking about the excellence of the engineering. There was no great groundbreaking technology on it. I mean, Ferrari very, very rarely did anything before anybody else. And okay, it was a V12, but, you know, people have been making V12 since the first one about 1916. So there was nothing new about that. The first one was a little 1.5 litre V12, so tiny little cylinders, but it had single overhead camshaft, two valves per cylinder, very, very straightforward. It was just done beautifully. And they got immense amounts of power out of it. It was legendarily bomb-proof. You know, you could do all sorts of terrible things to it, and it would just somehow put up with it. And one of the reasons that things like 250 GTOs were so unbelievably successful, because a GTO, like the engine that's in it, is technologically very, very conservative, is that not only were they, you know, they quick and gorgeous to drive, which, you know, which helped, they were just always there at the end as well. They just hung around.
They kept going. Yeah.
They just kept going. And when you're doing those really, really long races like Le Mans or whatever, particularly back then when, you know, it was by no means guaranteed that, you know, even most of the field would get to the finish. You know, sometimes you get, you know, Le Mans would finish and, you know, you would have 55 cars start the race and 7 would finish it. But you knew that if you had a Colombo V12, you know, in front of you, sometimes even behind you, unless something very unexpected happened, like someone binned it or whatever, or another part of the car broke, you were going to finish the race. You didn't have to worry about it because it would just put up with whatever you could chuck at it. And it is such a gorgeous... I think so many of these things, you know, we talk about, don't we? We talk about the McLaren and the LFA and, you know, and even things like that Rolls-Bentley engine. And so I reckon if you went back and analysed this podcast, we'd have spent half our time talking about the sounds that they make.
That's the key part of
key
it.
Component, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of, you know, because we'd forgive an engine almost anything if it sounded like, you know, the last thing you'd want to hear, you know, before you drop dead. And And the thing about that Colombo V12, it's why, you know, our forebears always used to talk about, you know, the symphony. And we don't do it anymore because it's the most frightful cliche. But what they mean is it's not a single sound. You sort of feel that if you could actually just, instead of have to concentrate on your driving, just sit there and listen to it, you could unpick all the different noises that the, you know, the induction, the exhaust, the valves, the this, the that, the other. And it is like an orchestra. It's, you know, because it's on so many different parts of the musical register, and it's so complex and so fascinating, and it's hypnotizing. And yeah, that's the joy of it.
Beautifully put. And actually, on that point about the sound of a Colombo V12. I remember being at the Goodwood Revival one year, stood on the bank at the first corner, and you'd have, this was the, ooh, you might have to tell me what race this was, but there was a silver 250 GT short wheelbase with the yellow band over its nose.
Yeah.
Beautiful car. And so it's racing, is that the TT or is that something else?
Well, short wheelbase, it probably is the TT, although, yeah, it probably is the TT. That's what they say most of the time.
Okay,
yeah.
So I think we're watching the TT, and of course you've got the Cobras going by with those thunderous V8s. You've got E-types with the inline six.
Yeah.
But the one that really sounded magical was the V12 in that Ferrari 250 GT short wheelbase. And when it would power away from that first corner, and the howl would just hit you. And it was like an old Formula One car. And it was the sweetest, best-sounding thing in that whole race. And I've adored that engine in particular ever since. Fantastic thing. Any others?
How are we doing? Well, I mean, I've got a few more. The Alfa V6.
Yeah.
Another wonderfully... I mean, a couple of V6. Actually, the Alfa and the original Honda NSX V6. That was engine which proved, you know, back in whenever it was, 1990... You know, compare that to the V8 Ferrari is making at the time. The Honda, the Japanese V6 was better than the Italian V8 in basically every way that certainly mattered to me. It sounded better, had better power delivery, sharper throttle response, revved higher. It was just like the Japanese was, just like Honda were going, well, you reckon that's cool? Try this.
Yeah.
Fabulous engine. I'm sure there are so more. I'm not going to get away with the flat 2 in my 2CV, am I?
No, absolutely not.
Okay. But the inline 2 in my Fiat 500.
Oh, crikey.
My air-cooled inline 2 in my Fiat was designed by Aurelio Lampredi, who also designed the 4.5-litre V12 engine that was in the nose of Froilán González's Ferrari 375 when he won the British Grand Prix in 1951, ending Alfa Romeo's stranglehold on motor racing. So there you go.
That's cool.
What a great engine.
You can have that. I've got others on my list that I haven't even mentioned, but we'll leave those for now because I just want to end this on with one final thought. So you suggested that perhaps if we had to declare one greatest engine of all time, it would be it's a 6.1, isn't it? The V12 in the McLaren F1, the Paul Roscher
6.4, I think, yeah. But I don't want to do that. I don't want to declare
greatest engine
of all time because I don't think there's any such thing.
But wait, no, we're not going to do that. But what I do want to discuss is that the McLaren F1 now, in a sense, has a successor, doesn't it? In the Gordon Murray T50.
Yeah.
Now, we haven't driven that yet, that car. No. Hopefully we will do soon.
It'd be lovely.
But the engine, when you look at the specs, do you think that might be the engine to displace the McLaren F1 V12? In your heart or in your mind, it revs beyond 12.
Yeah, I mean, I think if anything's going to do it that well.
Yeah,
because I mean, I think the F1 engine only revved to, I say only, I think it went to about 7.7, 7.8. So this is going to be completely and utterly different, but still a naturally aspirated V12. Gordon tells me that, you know, you think about an engine, it's quite a small engine producing that much power, and you think, well, God, I wonder if it's going to have any torque at all. I'm sure that it does. We know from hearing it go around Goodwood and from various onboards that we've seen, it sounds amazing. So I think, as I say, I think if any car has the chance of doing that than that car does. Haven't driven the Valkyrie, sadly. And that has another Cosworth designed V12, but a much larger one. I think it's 6.5 litres, isn't it? And that sounds pretty unbelievable too. But I've not experienced it, so I can't say. But I would imagine, I would hope that if anything was going to do it, it would be that GMA engine.
Well, once we've driven it, we'll come and report back, won't we?
Yeah.
So there we go. Those are our favourite ever internal combustion engines. And if we've missed any, you'll have to get in touch and let us know, because I think we've rattled through quite a lot there, but that can't possibly be all of them, can it? And I'd love to know which is your favourite engine, so get in touch. But just to wrap things up this week, we've got a listener question from Andrew Belton. And he says, a couple of weeks ago, in relation to something else, Andrew, you mentioned Trigger's Broom. Broom, as we know, it had 4 handles and 6 brushes or something. But Trigger, this character from Only Fools and Horses, claimed it was still the same broom. The point being, if you change every single component about
is it still
something,
the same car?
Is it still the same thing? Yeah, and so he says, Formula One drivers often talk about their car, but how much of the car that starts the year is still the same car that finishes the season, given the number of power units and everything that they're allowed to use? And that's an interesting point, but particularly in Formula One, they don't even have a single chassis, do they? They work through several chassis. It's more sort of, when we talk about so-and-so's car or the car from such-and-such season, I mean, this is why multiple examples of the same car seem to pop up all over the place, isn't it?
Well, yeah, absolutely. So, so the car, the identity of the car belongs to its tub, to its chassis. Formula One cars get stripped down to their barest components and then rebuilt. And, I can't imagine that. Okay, the rules is you have to use the same engine, don't you, for a few races and that sort of thing. The answer to the question is that the only thing that a car requires to be entitled to its identity is its tub. Everything
it's the
else
backbone
on
the of the car, isn't it?
Will be changed. I think where the question becomes, if I may say, perhaps, it's different and maybe more interesting is when you've got historic vehicles. So there was a very famous case. There was a Bentley which won Le Mans 1929, 1930. It was the first chassis to win the race twice. It then got changed quite a bit. It then had an enormous accident at Brooklands in 1932, killed its driver. And it evolved, got rebuilt, and it evolved some more. Anyway, the long and the short of it, it got to a point where there wasn't a single piece on that car which crossed the line at Le Mans in 1930. The car got sold, and somebody, I think the new owner, believing it was that car, discovered that there was nothing on it from that original car, cried foul, and it came to court.
Mm.
And there was a big court case that tried to determine whether this car, this Trigger's Broom of a car, was still entitled to the identity of the original. And they decided, because it had this continuous history, there were no question marks over what had happened to it, and it wasn't like, one car went away and another one just turned up in its place, that it was entitled to that identity. Mm. So it can still be called Old Number One, because that's what it was called originally, even though there wasn't a grub screw left on it that was on the original Number One. I think that's the ultimate question, particularly these days where provenance and originality in the old car world is so unbelievably important, and so many cars have changed so much over time. But I think ultimately, if a car's history is known and there are no question marks over it, regardless of what has happened to it, as long as it is documented, it is entitled to call itself what it was when it was built.
Mm. Gosh, that is a very, very interesting case. I hadn't heard that one before.
Yeah.
Blimey. Okay, all right, well, we'll leave it there. Thank you for your question. Keep them coming, and we'll do it again next week.
Bye.
The
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.